Welcome to the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. The rise of AI presents important legal and ethical challenges for society. In this podcast, we invite leaders from different industries and creators of new AI to debate the big questions. This is the AI Asia Pacific Institute podcast. Dr. Matt Beard is a moral philosopher with an academic background in applied and military ethics. He has taught philosophy and ethics at university for several years, during which time he has been published widely in academic journals, book chapters, and spoken at national and international conferences. Matt has advised the Australian Army on military ethics, including technology design. In 2016, Matt won the Australasian Association of Philosophy Prize for media engagement, recognizing his prolific contribution to public philosophy. He regularly appears on television, radio, online, and in print. With you now, Kelly Forbes, our host for this podcast.
Hi, Matt. Welcome to the podcast. I'm very grateful to have you here today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so a big part of our conversation today is going to be around the work that the Ethics Center is doing, and specifically about the paper Ethical by Design, Principles for Good Technology. So probably a good place to start is by inviting you to share a little bit more about this work and why you're proposing a universal ethical framework for technology.
Yeah, good question. So the genesis of this work was actually, this was organically based on the need that we were identifying from people who were coming to us. The Ethics Center has a really broad remit. So we aim to be there to support people with ethical issues across any kind of sector, any walk of life, from the personal to the professional, to the social, to the global kind of issues. And what we found about 3 years ago was increasingly we were getting more and more inquiries, more invitations to speak, more people wanting to partner or work on research or consultancy projects, who were suddenly acutely aware of the range of technological challenges that they were facing. And a lot of those were to do with big data sets that they suddenly realized they were sitting on, and they didn't know how best to capitalize on the opportunities, or they wanted to capitalize on all the opportunities, but they weren't sure if that would put them in hot water ethically. There were questions around AI, machine learning, and even broader kind of existential questions around, you know, existential risk. What does it mean if we get to the point where we have some kind of artificial general intelligence? So there were lots of really broad questions that we were being asked to think about. And we were doing that work sort of disparately. Different people were working on different projects. And when we all came together and started to compare notes, we realized that sort of without designing it, we were talking from a similar playbook. We were asking some very basic universal questions that don't just pertain to technology, that are kind of universal ethical questions that we would ask about any kind of activity. And what that made us realize was that there's probably something distinct about technology in general, and not just about specific technologies, be they medical technologies or military technologies or artificial or machine learning. There are some basic considerations that need to be articulated, and don't just need to be articulated in the sense of like, here are some principles, but the rationale for why those are the principles that are important is important to flesh out. We've seen lots and lots of principles-based frameworks being developed. But a lot of them are quite prescriptive in that what they do is they say, these are the principles and you will trust us on that because we have clever people who have come up with them, and now go away and work in accord with these principles. That's not the way that we like to approach ethics. We like to approach ethics as a process of bringing people to water, not forcing them to drink. So we wanted to show kind of how the sausage was made. We wanted to give a lot of information around what some of the philosophical ideas around technology are, the different ways that we conceptualize and think about ethics, and what's distinct and unique about technology in terms of, you know, the fact that it affords behavior in particular ways, the fact that the idea of a value neutral technology, that it's just up to the user to kind of decide whether they're going to use it for good or for ill, that some of these things are misleading and misconstrued. And then we wanted to develop a general principles framework, like you'd be familiar with, and a lot of the principles that we advocate for are ones that come across different principle-based frameworks. But then we wanted to talk about what is the fine line between getting more particular around how we operationalize those principles and being prescriptive in a way that gets in the way of technical experts and really creative people working on problems that we haven't anticipated because we're philosophers, actually being able to solve problems for themselves. And what we did was we came up with a series of kind of, I guess you'd call them tools in a reflective toolkit. So we've got these high level principles, which we consider to be applicable to any form of technology, whether that's a social platform, whether that's an algorithm, whether that's a piece of medical or military technology, whatever it is. Then we've tried to translate those high level principles into what we're calling rules of thumb. And these are non-exhaustive, but they're basically some more practical kind of maxims that help us to think through in an applied sense. Okay, well, what does it mean? Like if there's a principle around net benefit, and you'll see that in lots of different principles-based frameworks. Well, how do I figure out what the net benefits are? What are some ways of working out the limits on attaining a kind of net benefit? What are some of the side considerations that I need to consider when I'm doing that? And that's what we tried to develop in terms of our rules of thumb, are some, you know, more applied maxims that help to translate that and bring it closer to the level of practice. And then we advocated for a series of what we called design challenges or ethical design challenges. And these are open-ended questions. They're provocations that are designed to be used by a team kind of talking around a table that get them to kind of do some of the imaginative work of thinking through the various considerations that are there. Because we don't want this to be a box-ticking exercise, right? Where it's like, yes, we've done this, we've done that, we've done this. We actually think that it's more, ethics is about a reflective practice. It's about wrestling with the question that we're facing so much as it is choosing from the best possible answer. And so we built this kind of tapestry, I suppose, of different tools within Ethical by Design that we hope give sufficient guidance to practitioners without claiming that we know how to solve their problems best. What we're trying to do is empower them and provide them with an intellectual and an ethical framework within which their genius can work. So we're not in the business of constraining innovation. We're in the business of kind of funneling innovation and helping that to bring out the best of that, so that there aren't things that are being missed in the process. So that's really what inspired the framework.
Excellent. Okay. So if I understand correctly, it's almost as, you know, the work is in comparison to a lot of the other frameworks that have been made available, say, in regards to AI around the world, but in it's more specific to trying to bring that into practice. So instead of just putting principles and values out there, you're also thinking about how you can help practitioners to actually incorporate them.
Yeah, that's right. So that's why we wanted to translate these down into more kind of practical rules of thumb. There's still some work to be done there, where we've been piloting kind of taking these principles and rules of thumb and kind of just testing now some methodologies around that. Like what happens when we hand this to a design team and they go to work trying to use it to make something. And we've started to develop some processes and some facilitation models that help to bring these kind of questions to light. And what we found is that it's that third thing I was talking about, is those open-ended design questions that seem to be surfacing for people the really deep ethical concerns, the quiet question in the back of their mind that they're not quite sure how to articulate. and by bringing people around a table that are, you know, diverse in terms of the roles that they serve in the organization, that have different ways of thinking about ethical problems, that have a different set of responsibilities because of their function within a team. And then providing these open-ended questions in a kind of facilitated space, and then capturing all of that data in, you know, post-it notes and all the rest, we found that we can capture a really, really compelling kind of heat map of the different ethical risk areas and the different ethical opportunities around a product, just by giving people the time and space to really talk these things through at an early stage in a project, before there are deadlines, before we've already made some commitments and decisions, where suddenly if someone says, hang on, there's a more ethical way to do this, well, there's no budget to actually make those decisions. So we found that doing this up front actually helps teams to ideate in a really different way, and helps them to get a better articulation of the problem that they're trying to solve, the people that they're trying to solve it for, and helps to surface some of the assumptions that they might be making in the process. So yeah, we have found it to be useful. There's still work to be done, I think, for us to feel confident that we have given a resource that we don't need to be in the room for, to make sure that teams are genuinely empowered to feel like they can do this themselves and they don't need someone hopping along to play ethicist. But that's kind of the direction that we're trying to head in, is to find something that strikes, as I say, that sweet spot between giving a level of guidance and also being hands off enough to say that, you know, we don't have the answers to all of these questions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So let's jump in a little bit about the specifics of this framework that you're proposing, or the work in general. You know, like, what are the values and principles that you have there, and how are you thinking that can be translated into practice?
Okay, so when we at the Ethics Center tend to talk about kind of an ethics framework, we think that it rests on three different pillars. The first one is purpose, that you articulate the why of what you're doing. The second one is values, that are your sense of like, what's good? What are the things that are worth championing, worth defending, things that are worth fighting for? And they're partly connected to purpose. You know, if you're a law firm, for example, your purpose will have something to do with justice. And it would be weird if justice wasn't, or fairness weren't, some of the things that you valued. So your purpose informs some of those values. And then the principles are the things that kind of constrain the ways that you can go about achieving those goals. So, you know, there are lots of different ways that we can go about getting justice. You know, we can form vigilante mob rule and go about it that way, but there are going to be principles that constrain us from doing that. So we're trying to articulate a version of that for technology, but there are some particular considerations that arise when we do that. When it comes to purpose, we tend to think about purpose as a noun, right? Purpose is something that you have. And so if we think about a technology product, it has a purpose. You know, if you think of a social platform, its purpose is to connect people. That's the kind of noun sense of purpose. But what we realized when we thought about what technology actually is and the function it plays in terms of mediating people's relationships with the world around them, and also the fact that technology is an activity that we kind of do, it's something that we do, it's not something that we have, we realize that purpose is not something that can just be prescribed by the developers or the designers of technology, that actually there is a repurposing process. There's a conversation that is had between users and developers through the product, that is navigating what the actual purpose of something is. And we've seen some remarkable innovation happen because users have said, actually, this thing that you've designed for this purpose is actually much more effective when it's used in this way. And thinking about purpose in that way is a kind of a conversation, as a continual fluid process of kind of stipulating or offering, inviting a purpose and inviting ways of using a product, helps us to understand how we might want to design nudges into a product, how a product might afford particular choices or afford against particular choices, but also gives an understanding of the kind of open-endedness with which we might want to be designing, and how we might be wanting user feedback so that we can help to go, okay, we thought the purpose of this is actually is actually one thing, but the way that users are actually going about it takes it in a very different direction. What do we want to do about that? How do we want to respond to that? Is that something that we're comfortable with? And so by encouraging designers to think about purpose in this way, firstly, it brings them into a very user-focused lens. And secondly, it helps them to understand the various ways in which they are, through design, pitching and inviting particular modes of use, and not falling into the trap of thinking that everyone understands the exact way in which designer envisions a product to be used, that they're sending those messages through the design as well. Like, please use me in this way and not in this way, if they want to be prescriptive around that. When it comes to values, we don't prescribe any particular values when it comes to technology. What we've done is two things. The first is to say that relative to the various use cases that you have for your technology, you should be aware of the kind of the explicit things that your product is valuing, the product is concerned with, but also to be mindful that there will be implicit values that you are coding into a product. And that might be because of basic assumptions in the way that you understand the world, the way that you've understood your users. And there are some things that are just implied by the nature of what you're building. For example, you know, we talk a lot about that old saying, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people, which is a manifesto of what we call technological instrumentalism, the idea that technology is just a tool that people can do good or bad stuff with. One of the obvious reasons that's bad is because part of the act of making a gun is that you're making an implicit values claim that sometimes it's a good thing to kill people. We wouldn't be making a gun if we didn't think that that was true. So the technology actually comes built in with this set of values that we may or may not be aware of. And so we want people to be conscious of that on the values level. And the other thing that we wanted to call out, speaking of values, was a lot of what we are trying to respond to in Ethical by Design is to bring to the surface some of the underlying values that is inherent to technology as an activity, and especially modern technology as an activity. And that's the idea that what technology is there to do is to bring a complex, sometimes chaotic and unpredictable world more within our control. That is the thing that we are trying to do with technology. And the things that we are looking for are things that make things more efficient, things that make us more effective, that give us a certain level of control. We're interested in things that are quantifiable, that are measurable, and what we call is a kind of techno logic that we bring to bear on particular issues. And a lot of technology is built through the lens of this kind of techno logic, and also encourages people to think more broadly through that same lens. So we start to think about social problems, we start to think about relationships through these kinds of lenses. A social platform encourages to think about our friendship in terms of how many posts of ours they've liked. So it encourages us to quantify and commodify other behaviors. And we wanted to surface that and help people to see that there is this philosophical undercurrent that's going on in the design process that, if it's not brought to light, is going to, it's going to manifest itself. It's going to rear its head in different aspects of the choices that you're making. And then I guess the heavy lifting piece within Ethical by Design is the principles. And we advocated for, I guess there's 8 principles, one of which is just kind of like a governing principle, which is becoming really popular for people to say, which is, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you could. So we say, you know, can does not imply ought. And so that's our starting premise, is that part of what ethics is there to do is to restrain possibilities so that the possibilities that we pursue are the ones that we think deserve to be pursued. We don't just do something because we can. There are a myriad possible worlds that we can create with every choice that we make. Not all of them deserve to come into existence. And ethics is the process of working out which ones of those deserve to come into existence. And then there are 7 basic principles that we have. So there's the idea of what we call non-instrumentalism, which is that we need to be conscious when we're designing technology that there are some things that shouldn't be used as though they were just instrumental in value. There are some things that have intrinsic value that we consider to be precious, or that we consider to have rights. People are a really good example of that. Certain ecosystems are examples of that. We might consider certain political processes like democracy to be examples of that. That there are some things that we can't just trade off against other things, that they need to be protected and preserved at the core of what we're designing and what we're building. The second principle is self-determination. And I think this is one that is being overlooked in the way that a lot of conversations about technology are emerging, especially around AI and algorithms. We're having a lot of conversations around algorithmic bias, around fairness, and around justice. And those are incredibly important conversations had, and it's critical that we learn from those. I think that the next wave in that conversation is going to have to do with agency and the ways in which various decisions can undercut people's autonomy and kind of make choices for them. We're seeing a lot of attention at the moment around the, you know, the Center for Humane Technologies documentary, The Social Dilemma, which everyone in the technology space is watching on Netflix, which is all about the ways in which social platforms use data and analytics and machine learning and nudging to undercut people's agency for their own ends. And I think that is increasingly becoming a concern in the political space and in the space of democracy and liberty, that it's not just about the procedural fairness of an algorithm, that it treats everyone who it touches in the same way. It's also about the substantive justice that's achieved. And part of that substantive justice has to be that it actually enables people to make choices and build lives that are their own rather than prescribing those for them. So we really wanted to highlight and bring that kind of front and center in what we were talking about. Principle number three is about responsibility and the fact that we do need to take responsibility for the things that we build, but also that there's this kind of distribution of responsibilities when it comes to technology. There are some things that as a designer, we are responsible for. There are some things as a user that we are responsible for. And there are some things that designers and users have shared responsibility for. And we need to have a really clear taxonomy around what those things are in order to properly allocate responsibility, to properly allocate blame, and also to know what kinds of things we need to be holding quite close to our hearts as designers when we're trying to build products. A fourth principle is net benefit, which is, you know, present in a number of different principles-based frameworks. It's just the idea that you should be doing more harm than good. And the good that you are doing needs to be justified and proportional relative to the harms. The harms that you're doing need to be minimized as much as possible, all those kinds of things. The next principle we have is around fairness. Again, quite a common one, that we should be treating people in the same situation in the same way, and we should be treating people who have relevant differences in different ways that correspond to those differences. Accessibility features as a separate principle as well, that inclusive design is not just an optional extra, that it's a basic element of what we're doing. Part of what we want to do when we build technology and a manifestation of fairness is not just fairness of outcomes, but also fairness of process, that everyone is able to engage with technology. We don't make assumptions about what our users look like, and we don't make conscious decisions about who is an edge case or who is a fringe user. Basically, the idea is that everyone who might need our product can use our product. And the final principle we have is around purpose, that the products we design should be fit for purpose. They should do the things that they say they're going to do, and they shouldn't try to do things that are not aligned to the purpose that they're for. We see a lot of products now that that go to market that ostensibly are about helping someone with a problem or giving people a fun little doodad, like a kind of activity to do. But that's actually just the smoke and mirrors on the surface. And really the purpose of this product is to collect an enormous amount of data and use that to train an algorithm, because that's going to be profitable for us in different ways. And we're not transparent around that purpose. The purpose that we're trying to serve isn't a fair one or a legitimate one to begin with. Or the product that we've designed is not fit for purpose. So we're creating a recommendation algorithm based on bad training data. And so we say that we're doing all of these things, but actually the product we've designed is not appropriate to serve the goal that we say it's going to serve. And that means that the people who use that product, the people who are affected by that product, are put in a bad position because you've been dishonest about what this thing is actually able to do. So those are our seven big principles. And as I said, each of those has some kind of practical rules of thumb, some open-ended design challenges pertaining specifically to them. And it's our hope that that framework or something like it is genuinely a value for people who aren't just trying to build policy and regulation around technology, but also people who are on the tools actually building this stuff.
Yeah, so there is a lot there in terms of bringing completeness as well to, the industry. I specifically like your conversation about responsibility there. I feel that's something that's lacking in a lot of researcher conversations that we have, specifically to the challenge around AI. And I was thinking here about, an example that you're probably familiar with in Australia involving RoboDebt. And for the people that are not familiar with, this was a case involving AI in social services and how the government deployed the system. And there were a lot of problems with it that's just been escalated to extreme level. What was interesting there in this case, I mean, there has been now a few different legal cases from that. But I think what's interesting there is that who is bearing that responsibility, right? Was that the company that, created the system in the first place? Was it the government that deployed and didn't give the required monitoring? So there's a lot of questions there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good example. It's a good example as well of a product that wasn't fit for purpose. So it made a promise about what it was able to do and what it was able to determine. But actually was assigned a bunch of training data and a bunch of information that meant that it wasn't actually able to do what it claimed to be able to do. So yeah, there's two things that I think I want to say around responsibility generally. The first one of those is that we can often obfuscate responsibility as designers by focusing too much on the fact that a user has choice. So, and whether that user is a government department who is going to go off and build this and augment it in different ways, it's quite easy for us to wash our hands of that and say, well, how you choose to use it, that's on you. We've got this really good set of terms and conditions that come when you sign off to use our product that mean that we aren't to be held liable for any decisions that are made X, Y, and Z, without thinking about the ways in which we might have left too open the possibility that our product could be used negligently, or that we might not have done sufficient training and development to mean that our product is going to be used competently. On the other side of things, I think that that we can, and so that's the kind of instrumentalist view that kind of frees the designer of responsibility. And on the flip side, there's this very deterministic kind of view of technology, which is that the user is not responsible for anything. It's the developer who has made us do all these things and make all of these different choices. And to a limited extent, there is a nugget of truth in that, which is that, the idea that there aren't values and design prompts and things built into technology is a myth. We are permitted to make particular choices. We are encouraged to make particular choices. But there are also a range of things that that we do have agency in. We might be invited to use a product or a platform in particular ways, but whether we actually accept that invitation or not is up to us. Once we have been handed a product that has dual uses or multiple different uses, the extent to which we want to use that as the purpose was stipulated and the extent to which we want to repurpose that for different ends, that's a responsibility that falls to us. And I think we can mislead people when we claim not to have any kind of responsibility because this was just a badly made product. And the reality is that they're really sophisticated systems that take a lot of bespoking and customization. And there are actually hundreds of different choices that are made before something like that goes to market. So that's the first thing I would want to say about responsibility. And the second thing I want to say about responsibility is I think that there is a misnomer about responsibility language that makes people really hesitant around what extent they want to accept responsibility for certain choices. And that's that we tend to link responsibility with culpability, with blameworthiness. That, well, if you were responsible for doing X, then if something goes wrong to do with that, then you are the one who is going to be punished. You are the one that we're going to sue. You are the one we're going to fire. You are the one that we're going to lock away. And I think that backward facing view of responsibility, that it's about being able to track back who is going to be held to account, certainly is an important function of responsibility, but it's not the only function. And I would argue it's not the primary function. The primary function of responsibility is to articulate who is the caretaker of good outcomes and good process around a particular aspect of what's happening. You know, we take responsibility for a range of different things, which if they go wrong, we might not need to be punished for. But in a forward-facing sense, it's our responsibility. It falls to us to imagine those various outcomes and to try to anticipate them, because there's not someone else who can do that kind of work. So responsibility, also thinking about it not in that backward facing sense of, well, hang on, if I encourage a really strong view of responsibility in my organization, in my sector, if there's some kind of, you know, industry standard or some kind of policy measure that is really pushing strong responsibility, then there's a good chance that I'm going to find myself in hot water for that. It's a limited picture on responsibility, either on behalf of the people who are responding to that or the policymakers that are developing in that way. We also need to think about responsibility much more in a forward-facing sense, which is about, you know, who has a duty of care for particular outcomes and particular things that happen. And that's the way that I prefer to have the conversation around responsibility. And I think that's where things can get a little bit misleading.
Yeah, I like that. The duty of care is important, especially in such scenarios when we're thinking that most of the population wasn't even aware the system was being, applied to them in the first place. So they were not able to, you know, make those decisions or make choices, right? There was someone in place with a certain duty of care in a way.
Yeah, and there are lots of things that play into the robotic question. One of the most noteworthy for me is that there is an enormous difference between the way that a government or a government agency should go about rolling out new technology to the way that a commercial entity should go about rolling out new technology. When a commercial entity kind of rolls out a product, it's engaging with users on a contractual basis. It's a transaction. It's a business relationship for the most part. That's not the way that we expect government to relate to citizens. We don't want to be related to as customers in a business relationship. We want to be cared for as citizens. We want to recognize that this organization, this agency, this department, whatever it is, that they have some custodianship over our collective well-being as a society, over my well-being as a citizen and an individual. And I have a particular set of claims toward this organization that I don't have when it comes to a commercial agency. And that means that the duty of care question, the questions around the kinds of consent that are required, become much more complicated, because on the one hand, a government is empowered to make particular choices on behalf of its citizens and kind of can compel people to comply, which is not something that an organization to do. No one can force you to be on Facebook, for example, but a government can require you to register your information with Centrelink if you're on welfare. It could theoretically compel everyone to have a My Health record, which is the kind of centralized medical database, which again was a very controversial policy approach here, and ultimately you had the option of being able to opt out. It can compel those kinds of things, but equally, I think because it has that power to compel, it also needs to do so much more work to inform people and to try to win their consent through trust-based measures rather than using that kind of authoritative and coercive power that it has. I think that's one of the important pieces of learning that I know that a lot of government departments have taken away from some of the mistakes that were made with things like Robodebt and My Health Record.
Yeah, absolutely. So taking a step back, and you've touched on some of those challenges that are in the industry, what are the main problems that you see here in terms of bringing this framework into practice?
What we've learned by going out and piloting this, by working with some teams, we've worked in design teams in financial services in particular. We've talked about this framework at a range of different industry conferences, including with some of the big tech players. One of the problems that we're finding is that there are, as with any kind of ethical framework, there are a bunch of cultural factors, and there are a bunch of individual dispositions and capabilities and skills that are needed to make sure that you're really getting all of the good stuff out of a framework, like any kind of framework, including ours. My academic background before I worked in technology was in military ethics. And military ethics is an area that has, you know, very, very clear frameworks, really explicit, both legal and moral codes about what can or cannot be done. But oftentimes the biggest determinants of whether in the heat of battle, quite literally, whether those norms are adhered to or not, are questions of personal competency, personal character, kind of ethical muscle and ethical resilience, as well as the cultural factors that are encouraging or incentivizing particular behaviors, what gets praised, who gets promoted, what kinds of stories get told, what standards of success there are. Those are entirely separate kind of human cultural questions that sit alongside these kinds of ethical frameworks. And that is the piece for me that really needs to get elevated when it comes to all of these principles-based frameworks around ethics and technology, around AI ethics or data ethics. Is it's great to say that it's super important to think about all of the different uses that this might have. It's really good that people are calling out, you know, the potential risks that a framework might have on disenfranchised communities. But that doesn't mean very much unless the team who are being told to think about that have a series of skills that mean that they can have those conversations well, mean that they can exercise their judgment and know which way to navigate trade-offs, that they're in a culture and an environment that enables them to interrogate a brief, so that if they've been handed a particular project and been told, do this, and they come back and say, hey, there's a whole bunch of ethical concerns if we do it that way, that they're actually empowered to be able to provide that kind of feedback and they don't feel like they can't speak up or give voice to that. And it's those cultural components, both on an organizational level and then kind of the skills on an individual level and on a team level, that is the piece that I think that we want to be spending a lot of time working on now at the Ethics Center, because we find that when we give people a roadmap and we've surfaced the issues for them, there aren't many people who are saying, no, you know what, I'd still like to do it the more unethical way. That's not the challenge. The challenge is when we leave people to their own devices and when we give them really tight deadlines and when they've got regular cadences that they need to ship to, all of the things that are really common in a lot of tech organizations at the moment, all of the time that's required, the skills, the PD work that's required to be able to do this stuff really well gets put on the back burner. And it's not the case that people don't want to do this. No one goes to work wanting to build the Death Star, wanting to build something that's going to harm people. But sometimes the way in which we work and the way in which we ask individuals to present themselves at work gets in the way of a lot of the ethical protective factors that we desperately want to have front and center when we're doing this kind of work.
Yeah. And in relation to this work, do you think, now thinking about the nature of AI as being, and technology in general, right, in being cross borders, right, do you see this work as being translated into something universal? Do we need some type of consensus there when it comes to this?
This is a real challenge, and this is where I really admire the work that the IEEE has done around thinking about AI ethics frameworks, is that, you know, we have proposed something that we think is universal in terms of its application that covers a range of different ethical considerations. But it's quite possible that, you know, being produced by, you know, I've been trained in Western philosophy. I've lived in Australia all my life. Culturally, I'm white, middle class. There will be a range of experiences and perspectives that are possibly missing from that framework. And similar critiques have been made of a lot of frameworks that make claims to universality, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that these miss important aspects of, you know, cultural variation, differences in cultural expression, equally valid but very different claims to how we make good choices and live good lives. So I think if we were to kind of want to have a higher level of confidence in the universality of what we've done, we need to work with a range of anthropologists, of ethicists from different dispositions and backgrounds and cultures. We would want to be working with a lot of people who are familiar with decolonial work and the ways in which that becomes really important. So look, there's probably stuff in there that on a really basic level is somewhat universal around the idea. So we, for example, didn't choose to use something like, you know, respect for persons as a basic principle. We chose non-instrumentalism so that we could accommodate for the idea that in certain traditions, including for our First Nations people in Australia, environments, landscapes, the land itself is something that has intrinsic value. There's been a lot of controversy just of late around the treatment by a mining company of the Yukon Gorge, a really precious sacred site for Indigenous Australians in that local area. This was treated as though it had purely instrumental value. We just needed to extract from that area what we could, without bearing in mind the kind of non-instrumental value that this place held to people, that it was sacred. And so we want to accommodate for those kinds of variations. But for every time that we've tried to accommodate for that, there will be, I imagine, things that a second version would call attention to, things that broader consultation would draw attention to. So I wouldn't want to rest on my laurels in that space, but nor do I want to give up on the idea that we can build something that is to some extent universal, but also, like we've tried to do, accommodates for cultural variation, accommodates for individual variation. We play this game like it's binary. Either everything is absolutely true and the same for everybody, or it's different for everybody and there's no middle ground. But the reality is there are some basic commitments that we probably all share, as well as being a range of different ways in which we express those basic commitments. That's the sweet spot that I'd like to hit when it is necessary for us to develop something that is universal in nature.
Yeah. Okay. And that's touching a little bit on my final question that I usually like to ask, which is around what is your perspective on what the future holds and, you know, on the relationship of human machine?
Yeah, it's a really big question.
Yeah, it is. Whatever comes to mind first.
Yeah, I think there is, for me, the big question that I have, and I say question, but I probably mean concern, is that we aren't sufficiently mindful of the things that matter for us as people to do for ourselves, and that the possibility of automating those, and because we can extract some kind of value, whether that's commercial value or another kind of value, that we do pursue the path of automating those or relegating those to technology. So a really clear example in my mind of that, in Australia at the moment, we're going through a lot of concerns around aged care and the way that aged care works. And there's a lot of work that's being done in robotics and AI around how we can use these kinds of technologies to give people more companionship in aged care, or we can help them with functional tasks. And ideally, that would free up time if whenever we visited our elderly loved ones, we didn't have to spend a whole lot of time helping them to get groceries or doing basic tasks around the house, cleaning up for them, all those kinds of things. We would have more time to do the actual important work of, you know, having genuine connections with them, of sharing time with them. My concern is that, in automating some of those basic tasks of care, that actually those tasks of care are really important forms of communication. They are important forms of connection. They are the things that motivate us to connect in different ways. And that if we lose those and don't find different things to bring in to foster that actual personal connection, it will just be so easy to go, well, I don't need to go and visit Nan because everything is taken care of and I've got other things that I need to do with my day because I'm busy. And so that kind of falls off the radar. When I was had a newborn baby who was a terrible sleeper, I came across this crib that's been designed and it's incredibly expensive, but it uses some version of machine learning and data analytics to gather data about your baby to know when your baby is restless, when it doesn't sleep well, and tries different strategies, different experimentation to rock at different paces, to play different kinds of white noise,
wow.
to try to kind of optimize your baby's sleep, which as an exhausted parent sounds awesome, yeah. right? Like that sounds really appealing. At the time that I was reading about this, I was kind of out of the house because I had to commute a long way to work, kind of just before my son would wake up, and I would get home just in time to kind of tuck him into bed. So there was a period of time where the only time when I was actually dad was between the hours of 12 p.m. and 5:30 a.m. when I'd be rocking this terrible sleeping baby kind of and trying to settle him and get him back to bed. If there was a cot that was doing that for me, there's a whole heap of attachment stuff that happens with skin to skin contact, just with my choices and the way that I'm making the effort to say, no, I am dad and therefore I'm going to do these things. There's a lot of intangible value that gets lost when we automate some of these really complex human systems. And I think that for me is the big question is, are we sufficiently aware of the really complex and interrelated, interdependent web of human behaviors and the values that they give rise to and the behaviors that are important for us to make meaning, that when we automate a part of that system, we are accommodating for changes that might happen there. And this is not to make me a Luddite. I do believe in technology. I think that it's going to be at the center of solutions to almost every problem we face. But I also think that at times it can be an insufficiently sophisticated instrument for some of the environments that it's going to be deployed in. So for me, thinking about the future, that's my big question, is whether the complexity is something that we can address and manage.
I really like that perspective. And I think you're talking about essentially the existential threat of technology as a whole, right? Why are we building what we're building?
In some ways, yeah. In some ways, it's existential. In the genuine philosophical sense of the word, not in the sense of like, are we going to build the lethal robots that are going to wipe us all out? Like, I don't have that concern. I mean, I've got a military background, so I have views on autonomous weapon systems. But more my concern is around existentialism as a mode of making meaning in our lives, and the ways in which we can turn to technology as a way of actually not taking responsibility for our lives. There's a scholar who works at the University of Twente named Nolan Gertz, who's written a book about nihilism and technology and the ways in which our attitude to technology can actually be kind of nihilistic. It's a way of moving away from a sense of responsibility and meaning for our lives and letting that be handed to us by the kinds of systems and processes that we get involved in, the kinds of products that we use. For me, that is a live concern. And that's the kind of existentialism, that existential risk I'm more concerned with, is more the question of like, not is humanity going to be wiped out as a species, but are there parts of our humanity as a kind of value that we're going to automate away without realizing it and then scramble to try to bring back in some other way?
Yeah. And that's already happening, you know, it's not something just in the future, right? I mean, we already seen, as your example there with the baby, I think that's, you know, we already have so many technologies like that that can make our life easier, but at the same time, we might be losing something with that, right? And that at those times that you're exhausted is also those times that you're, you know, perhaps building memories with your child or building bonding.
Completely. And these may not be things that get in the way of progress, but they're things that need to be that need to be considered so that when we define progress, we're defining it accurately with a reflection of the broad array of different values that exist there. Yeah, I think some of this is kind of already happening. And I think that you're right to call out that it makes things easier. Like convenience is the Trojan horse here. Like the reason why we let different technologies into our lives is because they offer something convenient. And as designers, like sometimes the sweet spot, the real thing that the first question we ask is like, what is a pain point for people? What is a problem that we can solve for them? But we sometimes take, you know, I'm getting a little bit philosophical here, but we kind of take sometimes a hedonistic approach to how we understand pain. Anything that is uncomfortable is a pain point, and therefore we can solve that in different ways. But there are some forms of pain that aren't problems. You know, getting up in the middle of the night because you have a newborn baby, that is painful, believe me. It's not necessarily a problem. And it's not necessarily the case that the solution for that is some kind of technology that rocks your baby to sleep. The solution for that is better social policies that mean that parents can spend more time at home, they can catch up on sleep, that they can get more support in different ways. Like it's not a technological solution, it's a social solution. And I think a proper understanding of the rich tapestry of values that that we experience and that give meaning to our lives as humans, the kind of architecture of human flourishing, which is varied and complicated, that helps us to better articulate what is a problem that needs to be solved and what is just a part of the human experience that might look like suffering for a while, but which is actually something that we don't need to get rid of. It's like a kid falling off their bike as they learn. Like it's an important part of the process.
Yeah, things that we need to go through as humans
that constitute what it means to be a human. You know, without the struggle, the result is not quite the same. I see that, you know, those apps that they summarize a book for you so that you can listen to it in 15 minutes and suddenly you've read one of the great books of history. I think that, like, there is a lot that is lost just in that. There's a lot of nuance that's lost. There's a lot that's lost in terms of the work and effort that it takes to bear with something that is difficult, that is challenging, that pushes us intellectually. And instead of kind of looking at the real problem, which is we're all too busy to read a book, we've tried to make it possible to fit book reading into people's incredibly busy lives. And I think this is a really good example where, you know, you're not diagnosing the problem that needs solving accurately. And that, I think, is work that that the arts can bring, that an approach from philosophy and ethics, as well as anthropology and history and a range of psychology, a range of different disciplines can bring that helps to elevate those. And so, yeah, that's the big question for me.
Excellent. Okay. Well, it's been really great to have you here. Before we let you go, what's the best way for people to find you and find the Ethics Center?
So the Ethics Center is findable on about every social platform. We've also got a website, ethics.org.au. If you just look for the Ethics Center on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or Instagram, you'll be able to find us, and you'll be able to find me on every one of those platforms as well.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, Matt, for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.